All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a live episode of The Cinephiles here on The Cinephiles YouTube channel. I am one half of The Cinephiles, John Rocha, joined as always by my better half here, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
I reject the term better half. I also reject the thing that when you said I am one half, I'm like, that is not a half. Look at the way the screens are divided. That is a much more equal and I would say representative version of how we are partners.
Okay, fair point. Yes, half and half. Absolutely. I like the way things are. And for those of you who know, we had our live episode last week where we went and did the Oscars, our first ever Cinephiles Awards, which was a lot of fun. And we don't usually do back-to-back live episodes here on The Cinephiles, but we felt with the recent passing of the incredible Gene Hackman that it was upon us to do another live show to celebrate this incredible man, his legacy and his career. Let me get a better picture here. His legacy, his career, and all the incredible characters, moments, scenes, quotes, if you will, and just overall feelings that he created in us watching him do his phenomenal work in a number of films under the capable hands of incredible directors in multiple genres, Steve. So this was one that we kind of came to organically, but I think you pitched it and I was like, yep, makes sense, all the sense in the world. So here we are to talk about Mr. Hackman.
Well, I think we've done this a few times now. I think that maybe the first one was James Earl Jones, and I know we did the same with David Lynch, right. And it just feels right because when we're celebrating the life of one of these people that means so much to us, it makes sense to do it with the community that shares those feelings. And so doing these live shows rather than you and I recording a short or something like that just feels like the better way to do it. And when we're talking about an actor like Gene Hackman, I mean, I don't know how you'd figure out the Mount Rushmore of great screen actors, you know, but like Gene Hackman is one of the pillars. He's one of the greatest actors ever to grace the silver screen.
Yeah.
And taking some time to really talk about this incredible career live with, you know, our cinephiles family seems like the right thing to do.
Absolutely. And before we get going, we do want to say a big shout out to everyone who supports us on the Patreon, right, Steve? We just had from what I understand, a fantastic advisory board meeting. I unfortunately couldn't attend. First one I've never been able to attend, and yet I hear it was a pretty fantastic meeting yet again, and I missed out on this. But those are those ways that you can support us here on the channel. Is that right? Or on the podcast, shall we say?
Patreon is the most important way that you can support the show. Of course, just liking and subscribing our video here on YouTube or subscribing on one of the podcast feeds or leaving a review on Spotify or Apple, those are tremendous ways to support the show. But patreon.com/thecinephiles is where you get ad-free versions of the show, as well as our cinephile shorts that we were just discussing off camera.
Yes, a controversial one we might get into.
And of course our advisory board. And it was a fantastic meeting and you were definitely missed. It is the best way that you can support the cinephiles and on the advisory board, really help chart the direction that the cinephiles goes in the future.
Yeah. I don't know how many podcasts have a opportunity for the fans themselves to dictate the course or to offer input and feedback to be able to pick out movies or pick out a direction that we're going in. And certainly as we're about to get into this conversation and tribute to Gene Hackman, we have plans to dive into another Gene Hackman movie down the road because we've done so many and we're going to leave it up to the fans to vote on it. That's another way that we've kind of created our show to be a little more interactive over the last few years than we've had in the past, as we've felt the influence of the community to want to be a part of our show and want to contribute and offer feedback and advice and what have you.
Yeah, and there's going to be, just as we did for the Oscars, for those of you who voted for the Oscars, it's going to be exactly the same thing. we're going to post and we'll go up tomorrow a very simple poll on which Gene Hackman movie should John and Steve dive deep into. And all you have to do is join the free tier of patreon.com/thecinephiles. Of course, you can spend more and join one of the higher tiers, sure. But just join the free tier and you can vote on which Gene Hackman movie we're going to do a deep dive on in the future.
Absolutely. Another way you can support us, and we'll finish this section of the show here before we dive into Gene Hackman, is if when you're listening to us on the podcast feed, and please, anybody who's stumbling upon us on the internet, on the YouTube channel, please head on over and subscribe to us on the podcast feed. We have 9 years of movies for you all to enjoy and hear from us breaking down scene by scene every film. Just in case this is your first time, you're a big Gene Hackman fan and you've stumbled upon our show for the first time, we've been doing this podcast for 9 years, and recently we've been very fortunate to have some wonderful sponsors and supporters of the show here. So when you hear them during the commercial break and their products are something that you want to try, we'd really encourage you all to use our code when we say Geek Buddies. When we say Cinephiles, my brain's a little, sorry, y'all. It's a Sunday. When we say Cinephiles, when you hear the code, use the code. That'll encourage those sponsors to keep coming back and supporting us here on the show. So, I don't know, just like Gene Hackman in some of his movies, I don't always get it right, but I do the best I can, for God's sakes.
It was funny. Off the mic, when we were recording our last thing, we had a long conversation just about how often you and I mess up and how, when we're not doing the live show, those mess ups never show up. But sometimes you're going live and sometimes your mouth doesn't do exactly what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, and daylight savings time is always the toughest one for me. So, someone asked us, which Hackman films have you already done? Well, if you've listened to us this week, Steve, right, we've done new intros for a number of those Gene Hackman films, like Unforgiven, like The Birdcage, which we dropped yesterday, Mississippi Burning, Superman we did in the past as well. We didn't do an intro for that one, but we have done Superman in the past as well. And we've done Young Frankenstein, which had Gene Hackman in it, and a number of these movies earlier on in his career as well. So we've done a number of films here through, and French Connection being another one we've done as well. Is there anyone I'm missing here?
French Connection, Hoosiers, Young Frankenstein, Hoosiers. There you go.
Yes. Wow.
Mississippi Burning. And what's remarkable, even in the ones that we've done, is you have these performances that are really, really different.
Yeah.
From Lex Luthor and the monk in Young Frankenstein to the truly intense and scary performances like in Unforgiven, to the intensity of French Connection, and then you got him over in Birdcage, you know, which is a completely different thing. So, this just shows the range of this actor, and depending on what movie we jump into next, I am sure we're going to see even more moves from this incredible performer.
Yeah, and here are some films that we haven't done yet here on the show. We haven't done The Poseidon Adventure. We haven't done Crimson Tide. We haven't done Get Shorty. We haven't done The Royal Tenenbaums, which I think are all possibly in the running to be done. And Bonnie and Clyde, which we have not done yet on The Cinephiles as well. So there's still possibilities to do even more Gene Hackman films. But we should first go all the way to the overall thoughts here, Steve. I know we kind of talked about it in our initial intro that we did. I think it was for Hoosiers or one of the films earlier this week. But what are your thoughts now? We've had a few days. We've had a little bit of time to process the passing of Gene Hackman. Has anything changed for you? Has anything evolved for you? Or have you become even more appreciative of the talent of him as you've read more of these tributes and seen more of these remembrances of Mr. Hackman?
So I think the thing that has amazed me is it's the range. Because when I think of Gene Hackman, I think of Popeye Doyle, I think of Little Bill, I think of the captain in Crimson Tide. That's the first place my brain goes, is to the intensity and the power of this actor. As I'm sure you did too, and many other people did, in addition to doing little YouTube rabbit holes of looking at various Gene Hackman stuff, I watched three movies over the last, and I'm sure we'll talk about them, but I rewatched Crimson Tide, I rewatched Get Shorty, and I rewatched No Way Out, which I don't think I had seen since the late 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And what was so interesting watching it, it's all the subtlety of his performances that amaze me. It's all the humanity, particularly like in Crimson Tide or in Get Shorty, where he plays this such an ineffectual character is like, you go like, oh yeah, we know him for this big intense stuff.
Yes.
But in fact, he could do it all. And in fact, it actually is the humanity underneath all the intensity that is what made those performances so great. So that's the thing that really struck me. What struck you as you've been thinking about
that's it? Funny. Well, I want to comment on what you just said, because I think it's really great. I just recently rewatched the Actor Studio with him, the full, it's on YouTube. It's not great quality, but the audio is fine. So you can just listen to it without having to watch the video. But like Arthur Penn talked about that. Arthur Penn talked about like James Lipton, the late great James Lipton, asked him like, what did you see in Hackman? Why do you think Hackman is so good? What is it about Hackman? And he says, that's what you're seeing him do right now on the stage right in front of you is why he is so good at what he does, because he gets to the meat of what is happening. He cuts through all the other stuff and finds the importance of the moment, finds the importance of the scene with vulnerability, with honesty, with authenticity. And he said something that really struck me, a stinginess of not wanting to go too far. So there is almost a self-monitoring amongst the performance. And even Gene talked about this in response. He goes, I always have this voice sitting next to me that says, all right, you're doing it good. You're going too far. You're not doing enough or whatever. And it just worked for him. And he said it was really hard to listen to people tell him that he was doing it wrong when he knew his voice was telling him he was doing it right. So he has this just innate belief of what he can do really well. And he says this in numerous quotes, that he was trained to be an actor, not a movie star. So for him, right, the approach was always about the acting. And I have to say, as someone who gave it up a while ago, listening to Gene talk in these numerous interviews, which I read or listened to over the last few days in prep for the show, I find somehow a connection to him that's even deeper. Like I sensed an innate feeling when he passed that this was a big loss for me. And I don't think I quite understood it until I went back and read some of these interviews and watched some of these interviews. There's a lot of similarities. He got into the military he got into the military at 16 years old because he was chasing women. It was not because he wanted to serve his country or something noble like that. It was more a matter of that. And like for me, I got into the military initially because I wanted discipline and I wanted to lose weight. Those were the basic reasons, right? But as soon as he got out of the military, he went to be an actor. And for me, I got out, went back to college and got him to head off to try to be an actor. So there's these things that drive you, and people doubted him. He was working at a Howard Johnson's, and one of his former Marine officers came up to him and said, Hackman, no surprise, you're never going to amount to anything. He was just constantly told he was never going to be great. But he believed it. He knew he could do it, and he was motivated by it. And I thought that was really incredible to read and discover. So when you ask me what it is about him, I think there is something that I feel instinctively connected to as someone who's been doubted his entire life by numerous people in power or numerous people who are above me in station or ranking or whatever. And I've always used that as motivation. And Hackman had that within him. And so I can only say that instinctually, I saw a kindred spirit in Hackman, obviously way more successful, but something about him that I sensed instinctively. And so that's when you ask me what it is about him, that's what it is about him. He's great, and he's driven to be great and overcome the doubts of so many people.
Frankly, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I hope you'll forgive me for saying it this way. But it's like, but one of the things that I connect with you and Hackman is this is a working class origin.
Yes.
You know, there's yes. very much a, and I think in, as we think about how, what stardom works or how we consider art in the, yeah. in culturally is that it doesn't have working class origins, which is yeah. totally incorrect. It, but, and yet there is a feeling like, oh, the artists are removed in some way from yeah. the ordinary people. They are special. They yeah. are the elite. And yeah. like, that's not what Hackman is. And that's not how I think of you. And again, I'm not saying no. you're not elite. I absolutely do.
I don't.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah. but like, but the, it's going like, no, this guy who came from where he came from, who yeah. feels like a real down to earth human is in fact a great artist. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. And by the way, when you discover more about him, he is a great artist, Steve, not just as an actor. He wanted to be a painter. He started doing that in New York when he went there in the 1950s. He thought he could make a living doing that to supplement his desire to become an actor, training as an actor. Of course, it didn't quite work out because painting is very difficult to get into. But as he got older, obviously, and walked away from it, he rediscovered painting again, walked away from acting, rediscovered painting again, started writing novels. He published a number of books here. He found all these different things that he enjoyed doing, race car driving, being a pilot. There were so many things that he was inspired to explore and pursue. And I think that's another thing that makes him fantastic is he's a well-rounded person. There's a lot of things that drive him from an artistic point of view. And you have to wonder, he says he wanted to be an actor since he was a child. And I think there are people who are born with it. They're born with it. They see something or they watch something, and then there's this thing that grows within them that goes, this is what you're meant to do. This is what you love to do. And other people, you know, you could be a lawyer, you could be a doctor, all this, but with him, it seemed from numerous interviews that this is something he knew he was destined to do, even at a very young age, and even coming from a very broken house where his father left at 13 years old, just waving to him down the street and just drove off, and he saw him only years later sporadically. His mother died of in a fire where she fell asleep with a cigarette and set the whole thing on fire, and she died. So these are tragedies that he endured early in life. 1962 was his mom. Earlier than that was his dad. And so he had a lot of this damage emotionally inside of him, and this was the place he could go with it, you know? And so I find that to be also something really interesting about him as an actor and as a person.
Well, this is the great thing about, I in no way do I believe that you have to be fucked up to be a great artist. In no way do I believe that you have to have come from a bad environment or have bad experiences or a difficult childhood. It's not true. But art comes from somewhere, you know, it comes from experience and who you are as a human. And so the amazing thing about being an artist and the amazing thing about the arts, I think, is it's a way to explore and to deal with that and to take some pain that you have. I mean, we all feel this way. I'm sure most people who've been through a tragedy have had this thought of like, I need to make something good out of this.
Yeah.
How do I take my tragedy and there's got to be something positive to find. And that's what Gene Hackman did. You know, he took that pain and he channeled it into great art.
Yeah.
What could be better than that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so his path is really interesting, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, just seeing where he went, what he went through. As I said, 16 years old, joined him. He lied about his age. And the reason he got into the service, as I mentioned, was girls, but also because he wanted to leave home. He wanted to leave home. His dad left when he was 13. So there was a sense for him that there was something more for him. He was born in San Bernardino, but they moved to Danville, Illinois, and that was where he spent a majority of his formative years. And so there was this desire for more. And so he joined the military and went into all these things, the Marines rather, went to all these things that he did. But when he came out, that's where the path he started to find himself was as an actor, studying in the theater, and then eventually ending up at the Pasadena Playhouse with Dustin Hoffman. And both of them were voted least likely to succeed in their Pasadena Playhouse. He was not asked back for the following season. He says Dusty, he called him Dusty. Dusty was because he sucked up to the teachers and what have you. That seems to make sense when you look at Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman. But clearly, like I said, there's just this string of things where people are not believing in him. And he worked like parking cars. He worked all these odd jobs as he was trying to build himself through the theater and film to get established as an actor, going coast to coast consistently.
I mean, this is the working man origins of being an actor. And again, this is the thing, like I can tell you that I was in programs or watch places where the most talented people did not get recognition from the program, and people who I thought were not particularly talented at all were getting recognized. And then there's also the thing which you've probably seen too, which is some people it takes a little while to find how they're going to do this thing.
And talking about the actor studio in that interview, he apparently auditioned multiple times to get in, so he didn't get in for a number of attempts until he finally got in, and he had to learn himself what was the way to go. But, you know, he ended up working in a number of plays and establishing himself, as I said, then got on TV and did a number of things on TV here, a number of TV shows throughout, like Naked City, Tallahassee 7000, The Defenders, The DuPont Show, East Side, West Side. Then got into theater, as I was talking about, with The Saintless of Marjorie Kemp in 1959, Come to the Palace of Sin in 1963, Children from Their Games, and then A Rainy Day in Newark. But it was Any Wednesday in 1964 with actress Sandy Dennis that kind of opened the door for him to be taken a little more seriously. Then he got his first role in Lilith, this film with Warren Beatty and Gene Seberg, who recently there was a film about Gene Seberg with, I think, Kristen Stewart playing her, that was out a couple of years ago. You know, and one of the things he was cast in, Steve, which is really fun, I didn't know this till doing research, he was originally cast as Mr. Robinson in the Mike Nichols, The Graduate film. I think I forgot that from our show when we did it, but Nichols fired him 3 weeks into rehearsal for being too young. It was replaced by Murray Hamilton, but him being fired is what allowed him to play Buck Barrow in Bonnie and Clyde, because Warren had become friends with Gene and called him up to be a part of this and pitched him to Arthur Penn, who showed Lilith, the film Lilith, to Arthur Penn and said, we got to cast this guy. And that's how he got into Bonnie and Clyde. So an interesting journey for sure for Gene Hackman.
There's such a weird little bit of coincidence, and I'm just in my brain trying to think, because it was a long time ago that we did The Graduate, is a long time ago that we did Young Frankenstein. But the reason I bring them both up is, like, so my memory is that Dustin Hoffman was cast to play the German playwright in The Producers for Mel Brooks when he got the gig of The Graduate. And so Dustin Hoffman had to call up Mel Brooks because Mel Brooks had seen him in play a German transvestite in some off-Broadway show that was very something Noon and Night or something that was very famous in New York. And so he wanted to cast him. Dustin calls him up and says, I can't do it because I'm going to do this movie, The Graduate. And Mel is like, oh, so you're leaving my movie so you can go make out with my wife, because he's married to Anne Bancroft, who is the love interest in that. And then Gene Hackman gets fired off of The Graduate, which Dustin Hoffman, his buddy from the Pasadena Playhouse, is on. And then Gene Hackman is later a tennis partner Willy Wonka, of Gene Wilder.
Gene Wilder, yeah.
The Genes are buddies because they became buddies on Bonnie and Clyde, and because they're playing tennis together, that's, I believe, how he ends up playing the monk, because he goes to Gene Wilder and goes, I'm funny. I want to do something funny. And so this weird sort of connections with all of these things is really bizarre. I'm not sure if I got everything right, because those are movies we did a long time ago, but that is my memory of it.
But here's the truth, isn't it? I don't know if you've ever heard this before, ladies and gentlemen, but it's who you know sometimes in a situation that can get you into these films. He was nominated for a Best Supporting Actor for his role in Bonnie and Clyde. Then he goes on to do an episode of I Spy, which I could not find, but I've got to find that thing for sure. Then he was in Downhill Racer. I forget that he's a ski coach in that Robert Redford film of Downhill Racer. Did two films with Jim Brown to support him as he was coming in to becoming an actor himself, Jim Brown. And then got nominated for a Best Supporting Actor again for I Never Sang for My Father in 1970, which is an incredible play. I've never seen the movie, so I put that on my hat.
I've never seen it, yeah. Sure.
I want to see that. Then he was in Doctor's Wives, The Hunting Party. Then, 1971, so 1 year later, after I Never Sang for My Father, he plays the lead in The French Connection as Jimmy Popeye Doyle. That is, 4 years after Bonnie and Clyde, Steve? He is now, boom, dead center, winning the Best Actor and revolutionizing movies with William Friedkin's film, and a portrayal here that was, I think, just as good as anything Brando did in Streetcar Named Desire or in On the Waterfront. It's an incredible portrayal of what he does here with Popeye Doyle.
I couldn't agree more. It's one of those, like, he's an overnight success after a decade plus in the industry. You know what I mean? Like, he has been working it and working it and working it. And so when Bonnie and Clyde and then Popeye Doyle comes along, he is ready. Yeah. And you know, we said it when we did our introduction, the Popeye Doyle performance is incredible. And I hadn't thought about the comparison with Brando, but in a way, it's the same kind of announcement of a new kind of actor, I think. Yeah. By the way, this is a total digression, but I've got the Wikipedia page up next to me, and I was just kind of, you know, looking through at things. I had no idea he had been offered the part of Mike Brady in the Brady Bunch and almost took it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, like, is that true or not true? That little tidbit. So I like that that's an element of mystery within his resume. Was he actually offered it? Did he actually turn it down? That kind of thing, but it would be fun to find. The Gene Hackman Brady Show is a completely different show with him and Florence Henderson. That's Florence Henderson, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
But listen, but I mean, 1971 is when he finally makes it, and he's 41 years old. Yes, he was supporting actor, never sang for my father, but this is the one that explodes him, right? 41 years old is when he finally explodes with The French Connection, then goes on to do Young Frankenstein, as Steve mentioned, the cameo there. Cisco Pike, Prime Cut, one of my favorite films, The Poseidon Adventure. Scarecrow, which he did with Al Pacino, and Hackman calls that one of his favorite films, and that Pacino, he knew at that time, was an incredible actor. And both Scarecrow and The Conversation, which comes out in 1974 as well, are both tied for winning the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. So the two films that he is the lead in are, or co-lead with Pacino, but still a lead, are the ones, the two films that are considered the two best coming out of Palme d'Or. That's a hell of a year for you to have as an actor. By the way, 44, 45 years old when that stuff starts to happen for him. Pretty crazy, Steve.
I mean, just a young kid compared to you and I at this point. It's funny.
I don't know. I'm 35. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. I've never seen Scarecrow. That is a movie I've heard about forever. I've heard it's great. I've never seen it. I should put that on my list. It is, boy, man, he just comes into his own in this moment. And I know there's been some conversation about The Conversation in the chat.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a stunning movie to me. It is definitely one. There are certain movies in film school that got hit a lot. Things like Rear Window got hit a lot. Citizen Kane, Jaws, a whole bunch of movies like that. The Conversation, over and over again, scene after scene, particularly in terms of sound design and color control, were taught in film school. I haven't watched it probably in a decade. I almost watched it again. It's a hell of a movie.
Yeah. I don't even know if that's a criterion. If it isn't, it should absolutely be.
Totally.
Because that's an incredible film. I agree. And it's one of those unusual Coppola films. Like, it's got all the Coppola genius and artistry that he had in the 1970s. But there's also a little bit of a distance in the film that keeps you on the edge of your seat throughout the whole movie, wondering what's going to happen. And it's an incredible performance. They said in the actor's studio, it's like the most quietly reserved performance, where it looks like he's doing nothing, yet he's doing everything, you know. And that's a rarity when you see that. But, you know, then his resume gets really interesting, because it goes going back and forth between successes and not successes, because you've got Teddy Roosevelt. He played Teddy Roosevelt's former rough rider in a Bite the Bullet film from 1975, then French Connection 2, which wasn't that strongly received. Lucky Lady is a flop that he did with Burt Reynolds, Eliza Minnelli. He does a Stanley Kramer film, The Domino Principle, which I've never heard about, so I may need to watch that one. Then he's part of an all-star cast in A Bridge Too Far, a member of the French Foreign Legion, an officer there in March or Die. And then, boom, in 1978, Lex Luthor playing, Lex Luthor, rather, in the Superman movie, which he played for three Superman movies, 1, 2, and 4. And you know what, Steve? One of the things that I've discovered being a part of this nerd sphere or geek sphere is there are people who don't think his Lex Luthor is a good Lex Luthor. They essentially have the hashtag not my Lex Luthor because they think he's not actually playing Lex Luthor. And I say poo-poo to all those people because I love him as Lex Luthor. He is my Lex Luthor. He's the Luthor I grew up on. I love all. I don't mind all the other interpretations, but I love Gene Hackman's, and I will take no negativity around his Lex Luthor.
Well, John, I'm sorry to say that. No, I'm with you. Here's what I'll say is, like, so first of all, I believe that Lex Luthor is the first Gene Hackman I was aware of. You know, because I maybe I saw one of these other things around, you know, watch on TV or something, but I hadn't seen The Conversation. I hadn't seen The French Connection. I hadn't seen Bonnie and Clyde. Yeah. Like, I hadn't seen any of those. Oh, I know what. Actually, I probably saw Young Frankenstein first. So I probably saw my first Gene Hackman's probably Young Frankenstein. But the thing that those people poo-pooing the Gene Hackman Lex Luthor have to remember is that, first of all, the Lex Luthor that I grew up with is totally different from the Lex Luthor that was created post-80s. Good like point. Post Man of Steel and post that John Byrne run on Man of Steel, Lex Luthor became a billionaire industrialist rather than a mad scientist. Like, he was clearly a scientist criminal when in the 50s and 60s and 70s Supermans that I grew up with. That's right. The first thing. So saying not my Lex Luthor is like, well, that's not entirely fair, because you're, what you're talking about is who Lex Luthor is, was created after this movie came out.
Yes.
So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, you guys are so, you're saying I'm on fully on Team Roka, because the geek world of today just really needs to acknowledge how damn spoiled they are in terms of how much comic book media there is out there. There was zero. The only thing there was the Super Friends on Saturday morning cartoons and reruns of the old Superman TV show. That's what we had, you know, and maybe, and comic books.
Yeah.
The fact that there was a major motion picture, we were so great, and it was good.
Yeah.
We were so grateful. And did the Lex Luthor in that match the scientist in the purple outfit with the green things on him that I grew up with? No, it didn't. But it's a great performance as a great character. And so I understand going like, no, this doesn't exactly represent the comic book, but it is talented people making a really good thing, and a great actor creating a great role for that particular version of Superman. He's awesome. Is that the Lex Luthor I would write? No. But that doesn't mean I can't love that character.
This is Popeye Doyle 7 years later playing. Like, this is the thing you have to think about. This is, you've got a incredible actor coming in. And Christopher Reeve always spoke glowingly about working with Hackman. And he didn't always speak glowingly about working with other people on that film. And that's the thing. Hackman brought the right amount of strength. Reeves was a barely known actor at the time when he took on the role of Superman. Brando is only in the first 5-10 minutes of the movie. So you need to have someone who's going to be able to give your film that gravitas. You do have Glenn Ford, certainly as a classic actor in that as well, but you got to have someone who can definitely play the foil to Superman in a believable way, handle the comedy and the drama. That's the thing. There are moments throughout the film where there are comedic scenes with his Luthor, where he's not making a joke, but the scenes themselves are a little comedic. He never loses his menace. He never lowers the stakes of what's going on. And I think it takes a really gifted actor to do that in a superhero movie like this, where we weren't doing superhero movies all the time like we do now.
I mean, people just don't understand what was perceived as comic book. Comic books were considered to be dumb, stupid kid stuff.
Absolutely.
That adults couldn't, that was unworthy of adults to spend time with. So rather than going, how does the portrayal of Lex Luthor in that film compare to the greatest comic books made in the 90s, the 2000s, or today, you have to go to, how does the portrayal of Lex Luthor in that whole world compare to the perception of comic books at the time?
Yeah.
Is that it is so much more filled out and advanced and nuanced and all the stuff. I mean, it's a huge, huge step forward, that character. Yeah.
They didn't beat us up because we were reading literature. They beat us up because they thought we were reading kids' stuff, and so they thought we were nerds and childish, which is why they kicked our asses growing up in the 80s. You nerds and geeks have it easy now. You guys rule the roost now. But back in Steve and I's day, we had to hide that stuff.
Yeah.
Going into the 1980s here, we have a Barbra Streisand film, All Night Long. Then he has a supporting role in Reds, which is a film I still have not seen, and I would like to watch one time. Then he was in Eureka and Under Fire. He played the voice of God in Two of a Kind, which was bringing together Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta again in 1983 after they'd done Grease. But also in 1983 is one of my quietly favorite films, Uncommon Valor. And in a time, Steve, where we're getting a sea of Vietnam movies, and that started in the late 1970s into the 1980s, you know, First Blood, I think, was the year before in 82. I think Missing in Action is like 2 years later with Chuck Norris. Uncommon Valor is an interesting film that sticks out because it has a very young Patrick Swayze, and you've got a young Randall Tex Cobb, who you'll see in Raising Arizona, who also boxed, I think, Muhammad Ali or Larry Holmes. But in the film, he's essentially, Gene Hackman is a former military guy who puts together a crew of military guys, young military kids, to go into Vietnam to find POWs and deal with the Senate, who is trying to make it happen while a senator is trying to make it happen while other senators are not trying to let it happen. So it's actually a very interesting and good and well done 1980s film that people don't talk about enough. But those of us who are in the cult of Uncommon Valor, we love this movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I haven't seen it since the 80s. And so like, and it's funny, like, I remember it having a strong effect on me, but I really don't remember the, it's when these actors die and when you and I do these live shows, the good thing, I say the good thing, the thing that is really powerful about it is that, like with David Lynch, I watched a bunch of David Lynch movies. Yes. I watched a bunch of Gene Hackman movies. And I'm like, his list is so long, and Uncommon Valor is definitely one that I feel like I should revisit.
Yeah, I love it. And I think it's a dry run for what he's going to do 3 years later with Coach Norman Dale in Hoosiers, which we'll get to. He does Misunderstood in 84, Twice in a Lifetime in 85, Target, which I think is the one with Matt Dillon in 1985, for Arthur Penn, and then Power, which is an interesting film about what goes on behind the scenes with Senate and Congress and what have you, I think with him and Richard Gere in that one. But between 85 and 88, he starred in 9 films, which made him the busiest actor alongside Steve Guttenberg. That's kind of crazy when you look at that. But then we get to the seminal film, I think, and one of the seminal films in his career in 1986, which I think announces the next step for him as a performer, and that is a Coach Norman Dale in Hoosiers. You know, we did it on the show. It was the first episode I ever led because I loved this movie so much and wanted to talk about it. And I think his performance still resonates for me and crosses lines, because I'll tell you this, Lindley, my Lady Outlaw, sat and watched Hoosiers with me last year for the first time ever. She'd never seen it, had no desire to see a sports movie. She's not a sports fan. And she was transfixed watching the movie and loved Gene Hackman's performance. So I think that also speaks volumes about his skills, that he can make people who are not interested in that kind of film pay attention and watch the film because of the work he's doing as the coach in that movie.
It's what I was saying at the very beginning, is he totally can play the hard ass coach in a basketball movie, and it would be good, and we would like it. Right. But it's the vulnerability and the hesitation and the tenderness and the fear. It's like it's all of those things layered together is why you go back to that movie. And the sports part is great, and obviously it is thrilling as we get to that final game and everything that happens.
Yeah.
But it's the simplicity and the honesty of his performance that's what really makes it.
And I have to think that this is a film that probably spoke to him very strongly, being from the Midwest in Indiana, also having been discounted, having been overlooked, having been doubted.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was a lot in the movie that he brought to it himself. And I like that. You're right. I like that he has this edge throughout, but there are these moments of vulnerability when he's dealing with Jimmy Chitwood, from the initial conversation to later, when he's dealing with the young kids who walk out and then come back and through the dad ask for a second chance, he's willing to give it, you know, but he also has his lines, which is he's not letting the guys tell him what to do with the team. He's going to do it his way. He pushes back on his friend who hired him when his friend starts to doubt him. And then he gets Dennis Hopper on board because he wants to give that guy a second chance because he got a second chance to coach after he had punched that player when he was younger in his career. So there's so much about the film about overcoming things, having a second chance, getting a chance to show what you can do, and that we all make mistakes. It doesn't have to define us. And so there's so much that is that you can glean from that movie that I think is incredible. And his performance is the number one thing. As you said, Steve, the vulnerability, the care, the attention. I mean, just that moment right before the semifinals when he has them all in the circle and says, "I love you guys." And it's no coincidence that they went back and played that line before the film ends as a voiceover. It's really great. Yeah. Then we get what you just saw. Then we got Superman 4, which we can walk right past. And then we get No Way Out. So what was it like? I'm curious. I like this film. I remember liking this film. Kevin Costner, a very sexy Sean Young. Will Patton in a very insane role here with his commitment to Gene Hackman. So you tell me, what was it like watching it again all these years later?
It reminded me of why it wasn't my movie when I first saw it. I don't know. It's so funny because there is a certain set of, I mean, this was peak era of renting VHS tapes.
Oh, yeah.
With your friends and watching movies all day. So yes. And so there are so many movies from this exact moment that I watched over and over again. And I had seen it a couple of times, but it never really went into the rotation for me. And watching it this time, it's weird. It's a weird movie to watch. It feels very, very dated. The relationship with it's like, you know, we were joking about Costner when you told that story about No Way Out, because you told it when we did one of our intros, is that there's an arrogance to Costner sometimes. And it's really here where I just going like, why are we spending so much time with this guy? It's like the movie is telling me he's super special and that he has this amazing relationship, love story with Sean Young. But that's not really what I'm seeing. I keep going like, why are you doing this? And once the movie gets to, you know, there's a murder and it gets to the more thriller aspect, which is about halfway through. That first half of the movie to me was a slog. Once it gets to the thriller and we have more Gene Hackman, it definitely gets better and more interesting. But there was so much of like, I was like, I don't really believe this. This is not believable to me. But that being said, Gene Hackman, it's like his ability to turn on and off elements of his personality in order to play a certain part is amazing, because he plays a very intelligent and powerful person in many ways who's also filled with all of these weaknesses and insecurities, and he's really lost at a certain point. And to play that version of a Gene Hackman character is really, he's great in it, but it's not a movie that I love.
I agree with you in terms of he's great in it. Roger Donaldson, who directed it, has a very interesting career all over the place. Like, he directed Species, the Getaway remake with Alec Baldwin. You know, it's interesting stuff all over the place. New Zealand director. And I thought his performance was great. And I think Costner is damn good in the movie as well. And Patton, when he has that break, that is some really good acting. But yeah, the film maybe doesn't hold itself so strongly, but certainly it was one of those political thrillers from the 80s that a lot of people would talk about at that time, I remember. Then we get into Split Decisions, Bat 21, Full Moon in Blue Water. Then he was in a film called Another Woman with Gina Rowlands, which was a Woody Allen drama, Woody Allen drama. Steve, what do you know about this?
So this is might be among my favorite Woody Allen movies that nobody has fucking heard of or seen.
Well, I've never heard of this movie.
I haven't watched it in a really long time. I watched it. This was in the rotation. I watched this over and over again. Listen to the cast for this movie. Yeah. It is Betty Buckley, Blythe Danner, Sandy Dennis, Mia Farrow, Gene Hackman, Ian Holm, John Houseman, Martha Plimpton, Gina Rowlands, and David Ogden Stiers.
Wow.
It is the most Ingmar Bergman-ish of a Woody Allen movie. It is entirely not funny. It is just heavy, character-based, emotional, complicated story about relationships and affairs and humans being fucked up people. Wow. It is my memory of it, and I might even just go watch this again right away. My memory of it is it's a really great fucking movie with great performances from great actors.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. I've never seen it, but I'll definitely put it on the list to take a look at, because I'm compiling a Hackman list of things I want to see here. All right. And then right after that movie, we get another Oscar-nominated performance here in Mississippi Burning, where he co-stars with Willem Dafoe as FBI agents who are investigating the murder of a civil rights leader. And Steve, this is a hell of a performance. We really had a good time breaking this one down, as much you can have with a film like this, just exploring his performance and the changing levels of status that he has throughout the movie. And it is a fantastic performance that is on the razor's edge constantly, because he's not a clean protagonist, and he challenges you as a viewer when you're watching him in this movie.
I mean, this is the kind of movie that you bring Gene Hackman in for.
Yeah. Yep.
Complicated character, powerful, intense, layered, super, I don't mean superhuman, I mean a truly human portrayal. Yeah, it's a really good movie, and I really enjoyed our conversation with David McKenna, screenwriter.
Yes, David McKenna, who was so great in that comedy. Yeah, I listened to an hour of it the other day, just as I was doing when we were re-uploading it, and just listening to us talk about it. There's just such a reverence we have for his performance, and it's not driven by the fact that he recently passed. It was an honest assessment from the three of us of how much we enjoy the moments where he gets to enact his vengeance, which he does when he grabs Michael Rooker's balls, or when he's beating up Brad Dourif in the barber shop. But also the moments where he is trying to do good. He is trying to do the right thing. He is trying to use his strength and energy, and him and Dafoe, just great sparring between the two of them throughout that movie, in the two different approaches that they're taking to solve this case, you know? And we do know that a lot of it was bullshit, so no one needs to kind of clarify that for us. But I do want to read a quote from Alan Parker about working with Gene Hackman in Mississippi Burning. This is how he describes Gene Hackman's greatness. Gene is someone who is a very intuitive and instinctive actor. The brilliance of Gene Hackman is that he can look at a scene and he can cut through to what is necessary, and he does it with extraordinary economy. He's the quintessential movie actor. He's never showy, ever, but he's always right on. I mean, that's a great compliment, Steve.
That's I want that kind of compliment. I particularly like the fact that he said he's never showy, but right on.
Yes.
I think that's a really great observation, is that he can be big and he can be intense, but he's never showing off. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, he's doing, this is what's necessary for this character. I like that a lot.
Even as Luther, Lex Luthor, which could have been, and arguably possibly the most showiest role he's ever done, is still reserved. It's still not out there. And really, just the Miss Tessmacher is the only moments where you really see him getting a little bit out there. And so that's just incredible what he's able to do. Then we move on to Rain Man in the same year here. That's what he was nominated for a second Academy Award for Best Actor for that role, and they lost to Dustin Hoffman's Rain Man, ironically losing to Dusty there. And then after this, he appeared in The Package, which I put in the bowl with Uncommon Valor. These films of Hackman's that not a lot of people know about, but is damn good. And this is Tommy Lee Jones before Tommy Lee Jones blows up in The Fugitive a couple of years or 3 years later. He is a wily villain. I think he's an IRA guy, and Hackman has to track him down, him and Joanna Cassidy, who, of course, people know from Blade Runner. So The Package is a damn good movie that not too many people know about. Did you ever end up seeing that, or has it been since the
80s? I remember seeing it in the theater. Mm. And I have no memory of it other than that I saw it in the, you know, it's like, I can picture, I saw it in the Lafayette Theater. I remember going, and I can remember liking the movie, and that is all I can remember.
Yeah, and that's Andrew Davis, who would, of course, go on to direct The Fugitive and direct Under Siege with Steven Seagal. Was a damn good director for a little while there, had his window of time. And then after that, he's in Loose Cannons with Dan Aykroyd, which is so forgettable. And had a supporting
role. I've already forgotten it.
Yeah, exactly. And he had a supporting role in Postcards from the Edge. Did you ever see Postcards from the Edge?
I totally like Postcards from the Edge. I like it a lot. I actually, I think that movie is a underloved Mike Nichols film.
Oh,
I think it's a underappreciated Meryl Streep doing comedy thing. And it also has, you know, you have weird performances that you just watch on YouTube every once in a while.
Yeah.
Shirley MacLaine performs a version of I'm Still Here, the Stephen Sondheim song.
Yeah.
And brings the fucking house down, as far as I'm concerned, in that film.
Yeah. And for those of you who are young and listening to us or hearing us, or for those of you who may not know this, Postcards from the Edge is Carrie Fisher's memoir of living with Debbie Reynolds. And Meryl Streep is playing Carrie Fisher, in essence, a version of Carrie Fisher. And Shirley MacLaine is playing a version of Debbie Reynolds, and Debbie Reynolds from Singing in the Rain, because that is her mom. And so if you haven't seen the movie and you're a Carrie Fisher completist, I would argue that you should see this movie and explore that relationship and understand why Carrie had some of the drama she had in her life. Yeah, for God's sakes. Yeah. It's a fascinating film in that way. And I liken his role to like Hackman in Terms of Endearment, another Shirley MacLaine movie. There are elements of the amount of time he spends on screen and how he does the things that he does. Then you get Narrow Margin in 1990 with Ann Archer, which I've never seen, but I don't know. I don't know if it's okay. Then he does a film that I don't know too many people have seen that I really liked and kind of got lost in the early 90s shuffle, Class Action, where he plays Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio's dad, and she is a rival lawyer, and they are going against each other over like kind of an Aaron Brockovich situation where there was some contamination. She is defending the plaintiffs. He is defending the company, thinking that the company is the victim, and it becomes a thing where they circle each other. Their past comes out. Their relationship comes out as father and daughter, And then eventually things happen where they find themselves on the same side. So it's a very interesting movie. Highly recommend it if you guys haven't seen it. It's one of the last gasps of Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio as a lead in a feature film. And I thought they both had really nice chemistry. Then he does Company Business. Do you remember Company Business? Isn't the
which,
one with
which one is that?
I think who that's the one with it's him and Mikhail Baryshnikov. I don't know if you remember. What an interesting
combo. Hold on. It's directed by Nicholas Meyer, the director of Wrath of Khan.
Yes. Yes.
I feel this is, it's funny now that we're talking about this kind of movie because there's so many movies where I think I saw it. I don't really remember. I mean, it's like, I don't remember what your White Knights is with Baryshnikov and Gregory Hines, but I watched that a lot.
Yes.
And fell in love with Baryshnikov. And so I don't remember if that was before this. I think it was, but I think I saw this movie, but I have no memory of it.
Yeah. White Knights, I think, is 89 or 88. And this one comes out a little bit later. Where is it? White Knights. Yeah. White Knights is 85. Damn. White Knights is 85. Then Company Business is in 91. So an interesting film, him and Baryshnikov, basically the whole movie. So it's a thing. So you're like, okay, what's going to happen? Where's he at right now? And then 1992 happens, and Clint Eastwood convinces Gene Hackman to play the role of Little Bill Daggett. And Hackman said he didn't want to do it, and he kept resisting it, because he didn't want to play villain roles this late in his life. He just didn't want to do it. And Eastwood is the one that talked him into doing it and ended up winning him his second Oscar, and it was for Best Supporting Actor in Unforgiven. Steve, I mean, what can we say about his performance in this movie? As I told you the other day, I spent like 10 minutes watching some scenes. I watched more scenes subsequently. I'm going to watch the whole goddamn movie probably in the next few days again, because I have it in 4K, and I love his performance, and I love this movie, and I don't think this movie succeeds without him. As good as Eastwood and Morgan Freeman are in the film, you need Hackman. You need that formidable villain again here for the hero, quote unquote, the very, very flawed hero to overcome and defeat at the end and have that moment, you know? So what do you think about this? And we talked about it in our introduction, but is there any more you want to add to it?
Well, the thought that just occurred to me, and he's such a man of few words that I don't know that we could get much of an answer. Mm. I would love to hear why Clint Eastwood fought so hard to get Hackman in this role.
Oh, that's a great question.
You know what I mean? Because he clearly saw, because just thinking about what you said, this movie doesn't work without him, which I agree with. And it's not that there aren't other great actors that would have been great. But clearly Eastwood went, there's something about Hackman that I need.
Yeah.
That he can do that these other great actors can't do. And so I'm really curious of what that was, because what's so interesting between the arrogance and the charisma and the nastiness and the intimidation and the failure to build his own house and that little bit of comedy. Yeah. And then it's all these weird ingredients that Hackman manages to bring together in a way that I agree with you. You know, without that performance of Little Bill, that movie takes two steps down, you know?
Yeah. And Hackman said, I swore I would never do violent roles again, because he had gotten into this place where he was he was advocate for anti-gun violence. And that was a thing for him. So he didn't want to join it. He said, I swore I would never be involved in a picture with this much violence in it. But the more I read it, the more I came to understand the purpose of the film, and the more fascinated I became. And Eastwood said he wouldn't let go of Hackman. So he explained to him that what he initially thought about the action thriller was the utter contrast. He planned to use the movie to raise gun and violence awareness, is what he said. And he said, this is Eastwood's quote, that's the opposite of the film I wanted to make. Unforgiven isn't going to be about the heroics of gunslingers. I want to show the inglorious and dark side of the Wild West, the brutality of that time and place. I think we could make something that shows that side of gun violence was wrong. So it's very interesting that was what eventually convinced him to a degree to take the role, is the idea that it was actually an anti-gun violence film, which I don't think a lot of people necessarily take away from that movie. But certainly I think it's more a film, again, about second chances. William Money getting a second chance being a better person after being a horrific person, and he takes advantage of it. I think Little Bill could have had a second chance to, when he was the sheriff of that town, to be a better person, considering all the stuff he pulled that was, that rivaled to a degree what William Money had pulled in his younger days. But he chose to stay the same person he was before and use his evilness or his villainy to control the town. You know,
it's funny. We recorded that episode many, many years ago.
Yeah.
I remember us disagreeing at the end of the episode, and we still do. The idea that this is a movie about William Money becoming a better person. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. This is a scary, evil, evil guy who turns his scary, evil killingness on another bad guy.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make him a good guy.
I don't know. Fair point. You might not say it's a good guy, but he is the hero in the end, I guess. But you're right. It's
agree to disagree.
It's varying degrees of evil, right?
Yeah.
He took out a more current evil by going back to his past evil persona.
Yeah.
But you could argue, does it make him a good person or not? I think that was fair for sure. Then because he wins the Oscar for that, then he goes back to Broadway. He does Death and the Maiden with Glenn Close and Richard Dreyfuss, which the movie's not that great with Sigourney Weaver, but the play itself is pretty fantastic. Then he's in Geronimo, an American Legend in 93, co-stars with Tom Cruise in The Firm, which is one of my favorite Grisham adaptations. Then stays with Grisham and does The Chamber in 1996. And then Wyatt Earp in 94, which I thought was great. Quick and the Dead in 95 with Sharon Stone, Leonardo DiCaprio, and a very young Russell Crowe. And also in 95, I think, is one of what we're talking about, what we can talk about off camera, one of Steve Morris's currently favorite films right now, and that is Crimson Tide, where he plays Captain Frank Ramsey alongside the great Denzel Washington. So, Steve, what's your thoughts on Crimson Tide now? And what are we, 30 years later almost? 30 years.
We're old. So, first of all, very quick on Quick and the Dead.
Oh,
it's so interesting to me that he said, I don't want to do violence on Unforgiven. And then he comes back and does Quick and the Dead, where he's essentially playing a version of a similar character in a movie about gunslingers and who is the best gunslingers, which relates to Unforgiven, but all in a light Sam Raimi way. Yeah. I think Quick and the Dead is not a great film at all, but it is a perfect kind of a film of the kind that I used to rent with my buddies in the late 80s and early 90s. And you put it on in the background and you watch scenes over again and you ignore the stuff that doesn't quite make sense or is silly, and you just kind of have fun with it. So that's Quick and the Dead.
Can I add something? I put Quick and the Dead in the pile with Tombstone. These are fun,
totally
fast food Westerns that have good performances, because I think Val Kilmer stands out and Hackman stands out. I think Sharon Stone's good in the movie, but they're throwaway Westerns. They're just fun to have on a Saturday afternoon on the TV. But go ahead. In my opinion, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. That's what I think too. Crimson Tide, I think, is never talked about in the list of great films.
Yeah.
And it is a great film. It is, and I know you will not like me saying this, without question, Tony Scott's best film.
How dare you?
I know. I believe that I could back this up with facts if I so chose, but I'm not going to. I think you have two absolutely titanic actors at the top of their game going at each other. And what's so great, and this is the epiphany I had when I rewatched it, is I went, and it's interesting because we just did Wrath of Khan, is that I went, the epiphany I had was like, oh, the reason that I like this movie is that this is Star Trek, is that this is, we're on a ship, we have all competent people, all people who are, they're no bad guys, we're all trying to do the right thing, we disagree on what the right thing is, and we're battling with each other to make it happen, and in the end, we are going to save the day at the very last minute. Like, it really engages, and it engages in these philosophical ideas, which do not have right answers.
Yeah.
Like, there is not, you know, like, there's a scene which I would teach in film school, which is the scene where they're all sitting down to dinner in the officer's mess, and they're arguing about nuclear war, and then Gene Hackman turns it on Denzel Washington as a test. And it is so, it's such a perfect scene in terms of establishing character and conflict and all of the relationships. That movie, I think, top to bottom, is thrilling. It's exciting. It's challenging. It's stressful, and man, if you just sit and watch Gene Hackman's performance, there is so much there than you think there is the first time.
Oh,
there
yeah.
is so much subtlety and nervousness and insecurity and bluster that's fake and anger and all of these things that he's going through. And I will say it again. This is not a bad guy. This is a guy yeah. heroically trying to fulfill his duty in the way that he conceives it.
He has a code.
Yeah.
And he follows that code just like Denzel follows his, which is what makes the film a fascinating film, because you don't know which side you're on as you're watching the movie, and you see the logic of both sides, and no one is coming off overtly evil. So you're like, what is the right choice? And that lets you feel like you're a member of the crew, because the crew themselves are questioning who to follow in the situation.
Yeah. And to me, it mirrors what we don't want to see about the world, which is like, we want to see like, this is the good guy, this is the yeah. bad guy, this is the right choice, this isn't the right choice. That's how right. we want to see things. But right. the fact is, humans are terrible at predicting the future. We don't know what's going to happen next. Right. It could be that, you know, you buy stock in a company, and then there's a big flood, and that company loses money. Well, you didn't know that big flood was coming. But yes. what Crimson Tide is, there are things happening in the world that are incredibly consequential, and yeah. we don't know what they are. And we yep. have to make decisions based on the incomplete information we have in hand. Yep. And those decisions are extremely complicated. That is us trying to figure out what to do in the future in all sorts of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as you said, this is an incredible cast. Denzel Washington, Gene Hackman, just to start off as the two leads. Then you have George Zunza, who's a really good character.
So good.
Matt Craven, another good character actor. A young Viggo Mortensen, a young James Gandolfini in this film as well. And you've got Danny Nucci, who was the Italian kid in Titanic there with DiCaprio. Ricky Schroeder getting a chance to stretch his wings in a theatrical way. And a young Steve Zahn being a part of this as well. So quite a lot of interesting cast members being a part of this film. And also the element of the racial element in the film, I thought was handled really well as well, because he's a young black officer trying to establish himself, but taking the chance to go against the older white officer who clearly has a lot of loyalty among the crew, because this is his crew. He, Denzel, was brought into the crew for this mission. So it's like, who do they listen to? So I like that film as well, even though I think Top Gun is a better movie. All right, let's move on. But then we get a little bit of comedy here in the same year, Steve, which I think is fantastic to kind of juxtapose what he does in Crimson Tide. He plays Harry Zim in Get Shorty. And as you were mentioning earlier, I mean, this is such an unusual character for him to play. But again, it's a character that I think is really gutsy for an actor to play like him, who has played some pretty vicious characters, has played a strong lead in Popeye Doyle there in The French Connection. He plays kind of a corrupt movie producer who thinks he's always one step ahead when he's three steps behind everything. And I think his humor is so well done here, and it's very Hollywoody in so many ways. You know, it's almost like a Roger Corman who's not as smart as Roger Corman was, you know?
So I watched it last night. Hmm. I hadn't seen it in a while. It is such an enjoyable movie.
It really
like,
is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't put it in like this is great cinema. I put it in I could watch that anytime. It's totally fun. It, strangely enough, this is just how I felt watching it last night. I was like, is this my favorite John Travolta performance?
Wow.
It might be. I mean, like, okay. you know, like you are a far bigger John Travolta guy than I am. Hmm. I like a lot of John Travolta, but the solidity of his character in this is really fun.
Yeah.
The world, it's so funny. I know I've said this before, but before I moved to Los Angeles and became involved in the film industry, yeah. I would watch movies like The Player or Swimming with Sharks right. and go like, oh, these are ridiculous farces about Hollywood. And then when I came here, I was like, oh, no, these aren't farces at all. Things are just this ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that is how I feel about Get Shorty. The Gene Hackman character is exactly how many producers I've met are, which is an overinflated sense of their own ego, total denial of their weaknesses,
yeah.
continually scrambling for all these things that don't entirely make sense, many of which just have to do with their ego.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we see with Hollywood producers all the time. It's like, we want to think that everyone are these geniuses who have everything worked out, but they really don't. They're just dudes with an office and a script and trying to get some money for something, you know?
And they're willing to get money from anywhere as long as they get the film done. As long as they get the film done. And they try to hit on their leading ladies all the time. It's 100% the truth. I don't know if it's his greatest performance, but I will say it's one of his most relaxed and fun performances. It is a unique performance in Travolta's career. Like, it really is. And when you watch it, you're like, oh, I want to be friends with this guy. And you don't always feel that way with a John Travolta performance, but that movie is where you're like, oh man, that'd be a cool guy to be friends with. Like, if you could, if that was the actual Travolta, you'd want to be friends with him. And then the next year after that, as if that wasn't already incredible enough in terms of going into a little bit of the comedy, then we get 1996's Birdcage. I thought I had a picture for that, but maybe I don't. I guess I have to look for it. But yeah, Birdcage with Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. Steve, this is an incredible performance on so many levels, playing a senator, a conservative senator who's caught in a affair or in a drama and in the scandal, and goes down there to South Florida, supposedly meet the parents of his daughter's intended husband. And it goes insane, and we end with him dressed in drag, walking out of the club singing We Are Family. So what a performance by Gene Hackman in this movie.
So two things. One is, you know, we obviously just talked about it in our new intro. We had a fantastic conversation with Michael Vogel about it, which I highly recommend. The movie is hilarious, and the kind of movie, it's classic farce. And it's that is not a thing that Hollywood really does very much anymore, because comedies generally don't make money, you know, the way they once did. But this is a perfect one, top to bottom, really, really funny, great performances from everyone, including Hackman. And it's great to see him in his own way be as funny as Hank Azaria, Robin Williams, or Nathan Lane are in their way.
Yeah.
Like, and Diane Wiest. Like, they're all really, really funny. That's the first thing I'll say. The second thing I'll say is that watching Birdcage, and I would say Get Shorty, and even No Way Out, too, are movies where you go, oh, this is what actors do. It's like, because if you watch French Connection and Unforgiven and Mississippi Burning, you go, oh, that's Gene Hackman, you know. Right. But if you add Hoosiers and now you add Birdcage and No Way Out and Get Shorty, then you go like, oh, he can do a whole bunch of different stuff.
Right.
He is doing what's necessary for, he understands this is what the Birdcage is. And this is what my role is within the Birdcage. I know how to play this position on the team. It's like you go, all right, I have the world's greatest pitcher. And so you just have them pitch. And this is going like, oh, no, this guy could also play shortstop if you need him to. He can get behind. He can be a catcher. And he can bunt. He can run the bases. He can do all the stuff.
Yeah.
You just have to let him play. You know, he'll play all the parts. Yeah. He's great.
I agree. I mean, this is just such a great image. I mean, what a perfect look. I mean, who would have ever thought Gene Hackman in drag? And I'll bring this up because I think this is a really important reason why he got this role so correct. He said in the past that he has always been an actor who encourages other actors, when he was asked to train or talk about acting, to be in touch with not only their masculine side, but their feminine side as well. Like, it's really important to bring that out, the masculine and the feminine. And of course, nowadays there's a much more of a kaleidoscope that we're aware of gender identity. But in the approach he had, is that idea of the feminine and the masculine working in conjunction as an actor, so you can draw upon both when you need to for certain situations. And I have to think him drawing on the feminine part of himself to dress in drag and do the dancing and even mouthing the words of the song, and then having the moment where people aren't dancing with him and he feels self-conscious about it. These are really great elements that show you that he is a guy who is just massively insecure and has found his way into being a senator, but clearly can't handle the heat getting turned up and looks for acceptance wherever he can find it. And I thought that was a great performance from him overall. And that's something to say when you stand out in a film with Nathan Lane and Robin Williams, Steve.
Yep.
Yeah. And a young Calista who was not at her powers just yet. All right, so then we do Extreme Measures with Hugh Grant, which I've never seen.
Never seen it.
Yeah. He reunites with Clint Eastwood in Absolute Power, which I think was a forgettable movie from what I remember.
Also haven't seen it.
Yeah, then he did Twilight with Paul Newman, which is for director Robert Benton, which is one of those kind of smaller type of noir films that didn't quite get there for me. Then he's the villain in Ants, playing Mandible, and he's great as the villain in Ants with him and Woody, ironically now, playing opposite each other in that film. Do you remember him in Ants at all?
I have the vaguest memory of Ants. I remember it's one of those weird things of like, I saw Bug's Life a lot. There and I go. Saw Ants once, and it was fun.
I saw Ants, I think, in London with our crew there when we went to study. Me and Mike and a couple other people, I think, went to go see it there in London. But then he does Enemy of the State in 1998, which is a lot of people think is the spiritual sequel to The Conversation. What do you remember about this film with him and Will Smith, man?
I found it a totally likable and mostly forgettable film.
It's Tony Scott again, isn't it?
Tony Scott. It is. Well, and this is the thing. It would be interesting to look because I haven't really tested this theory out.
Yeah.
But I think Tony is the more consistent Scott brother. That Ridley is the has made more great films without question.
Right.
But Ridley has also made, you know, because he'll make two or three totally forgettable films in a row that don't work. And then he'll come back with, oh, I guess he can still make a great film. Whereas Tony is more the craftsman, kind of the workman-like, you know, guy. And so when you get a movie like Crimson Tide, or I'll give you Top Gun if you want, it's, you know, those pop up. My feeling of Enemy of the State was like, this is a perfectly well-made movie with a young star who is becoming a great star. And the most interesting thing about it is also the thing that doesn't actually work, really, which is it's sort of the spiritual successor or sequel to The Conversation, except that it isn't, you know, and so it doesn't actually work as that. It's like this weird little tease that to get you in the theater, but it isn't that thing. I liked it. I don't know. What's your feeling about it?
Yeah, I liked it. It's not on the top list of Tony Scott movies for me. Perfectly serviceable, but a bit hollow at times and a bit showy from Will at times, because this is a young Will fully understanding the power that he has and being able to act however he wants in that movie and swagger around the film. And so at times it seems like a power struggle between the two, because Will is trying to really establish himself as a movie star and Hackman is coming to it as an actor. And I think you see the smashing together. It's not that Will isn't a good actor. I'm not saying that. Certainly his first film, Six Degrees of Separation, he was excellent in that, playing a much more dramatic role. But here, this is Will trying to be bad boys, this is the Will phase of him. And I think the film rings hollow because of that. It could have had much more depth or much more power to it if he had come to it as an actor more than a movie star. And so I think there's where the issues lie. And I don't think the character from The Conversation would be doing what he does in Enemy of the State. But that being said, this is kind of like Never Say Never Again, in that it evokes Bond, but not really Bond. And this evokes, was it Harry? Or I forget the
Harry. Harry something. Yeah. I don't remember.
That in The Conversation, but isn't really fully the guy from The Conversation. Yeah. All right. Then we get what, and then we go into the 2000s here, Steve. We're getting towards the end of his career. He does Under Suspicion with Morgan Freeman, which I don't think a lot of people saw. The Replacements, which is kind of quietly a favorite of a lot of people who enjoy sports movies. It's based on my 1987 Washington Skins, who used replacement players and won all their games with replacement players. So it's based on that with him and Keanu Reeves. This also led to him doing the voiceover for one of the America's Game NFL videos on the Washington football team there in our Super Bowl year. Then he was with Owen Wilson in Behind Enemy Lines. A lot of people say this is a good movie. I've never seen it, but a lot of people say they really like that film. So
I haven't seen either.
Got to put that on the list for me. Then he's in with Sigourney Weaver and Jennifer Love Hewitt in Heartbreakers. And then he was in Mammoth.
Very quick story, which is like, I've never seen Heartbreakers, but it's one of those weird Hollywood things where I strongly believe that this project was in some way stolen from a friend of mine, because I had a buddy who signed a development deal for a movie with a mother-daughter crime con artist leads who go on this adventure, and it was supposed to, and they had it was a big deal.
Wow.
And Jennifer Love Hewitt and Jamie Lee Curtis were somewhat attached, and then the whole thing fell apart. And then like 2 years later, this movie comes out with Jennifer Love Hewitt and Sigourney Weaver as mother daughter. And I was like, I think they kind of screwed my friend Dave here. That's how I And like these things can happen totally organically, but it also can happen of like, oh, there's this development thing that fell apart over here. The idea is kind of good. Maybe we can make that work over here.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then he does David Mamet's film Heist as an aging professional thief of considerable skill who is forced into one final job. He has a cameo in The Mexican, which I don't even remember. And then he plays Royal Tenenbaum in the 2001 Wes Anderson film, The Royal Tenenbaums. And this is, I went back and watched a number of scenes from this film. He is so fantastic in this movie. Like, it's, to me, I know there are other films that come after it, but this is maybe the last hurrah of how great he is. And it's a role that he is not, you would never typically see him play, but he plays it with such gusto. And I think of the scene where him and Ben Stiller are in the in the closet after he's taken off with Stiller's kids, and they come back, and he yells at him. He's, "Are you listening to me?" "Yes." And they have this back and forth, which is really great. And there is, again, the vulnerability. He's an asshole. He was terrible to these kids, but there is a vulnerability to him that's really touching. So by the end of the movie, when they're all having their closure conversations with him, it's really touching and it's really moving. And I loved him in the movie, even though he is the definition of the word cad. He is a cad, but yet it works so well to see him in that film. What'd you think of him in Royal Tenenbaums?
I like the movie a lot. I think his performance is, again, it just shows this like, oh, this guy could act. Because this isn't like any of the other characters he's played. It has connections with a bunch of them. And it is just... This is when I'm discovering Wes Anderson, because
you know,
I'd seen Rushmore and then this is a movie that came through when I did the DVD. So I watched it a lot. And so it's just one of these weird things about that movie is you can't feel comfortable with any of the characters.
Yeah.
You know, all of the characters you kind of sometimes like, and then kind of you're like, oh my God, what are you doing? The collision of all these very special people, I would say, is pretty hilarious.
These geniuses.
Yeah.
I mean, I would hate to be in a family full of geniuses. No thanks. No thanks. But I think it so works because he's so different than all of them. I mean, it's to the point where you are like, how is this guy their father? How did this guy make these children with Angelica Houston? I can see Angelica Houston being their mom. I don't know if I can see Hackman being their dad, but that's kind of why they're so messed up, because Hackman was their dad in the film. And that makes the film so much fun to watch. All right. So after that, what do we get? He gets nominated for a Golden Globe Award for that. He didn't get an Oscar nomination, but he got a Golden Globe Award for Best Actor in a Motion Picture Musical Comedy for his performance. So I think that's the last big award he wins for his acting. In 2003, he does another great Grisham legal drama, Runaway Jury, working finally with Dustin Hoffman. So the second to last film he does is that full circle moment where both of them have established themselves, won Oscars, done numerous types of films in different genres, been uber successful, and finally get a chance to work together. It's a good film. It's not a great film. That's why I think The Tenenbaums is the last gasp, because it's a great performance and a great film. I think Runaway Jury is a good film. It's not a great film. And I do like Rachel Weisz and John Cusack in the movie. And I think the film has a strong commentary about the tobacco industry and about how these corporations fix certain cases in order to win. So it's a pretty good film. Did you ever get a chance to see this?
No, that's one I haven't seen.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Highly recommend. Him and Hoffman have an awesome scene in the bathroom, like just an incredible theater type scene in the bathroom that is very well written. So I recommend that. And then we get to the end of his career here, Steve, because the next year he does Welcome to Mooseport with Ray Romano. And that was it for him. He retired from acting, and other than doing some voiceover work for some TV shows or for some movies, this is pretty much it for him. And his last appearance on screen, whether TV or film, was in an episode of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives with Guy Fieri, who went to a Santa Fe diner where Hackman was eating. So it's just an interesting situation. And why did he retire? This is what he said in 2009. "The straw that broke the camel's back was actually a stress test that I took in New York. I don't know if any of you have taken a stress test, but I've done two of those. They're for your heart. It's to see where you're at heart-wise. And the doctor advised me that my heart wasn't in the kind of shape that I should be putting it under any stress. And that's why he retired. But Steve, what do you think about him leaving in 2004 as an actor and never getting a chance to really see him on screen again doing anything?
I have two totally separate thoughts.
Okay.
One, the first thought is, as a fan of Gene Hackman and of his work, it made me really sad.
Yes.
And I just like, oh, I want more of him in all sorts of roles.
Yeah.
As a fan of humans, any human who makes the decision to no longer work in our industry, I have, particularly when it's for their health or mental health, I have a lot of respect for.
Yeah.
You know, if that's what he felt was right for him, I'm 100% support the decision. But it's sad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Great point, Jim. It's like Connery doing League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and that was it for him. He was done. Yeah. To me, it's heartbreaking because you hope to see more great performances as an actor gets older and older. Because I would say that most actors feel like they finally understand the craft right when they get into their 70s or 80s, because it's when you're stripped away everything else and you just understand the truth and the sentiment and you have enough experience to really get to where you need to get to. So there are probably some really great performances that we were robbed of because he retired. But that being said, that also what makes kind of gives his career a little bit of a James Dean-ish type of energy, because he took himself out in 2004 from the game and then never came back. And for 21 years, he never came back and was on screen in a written role. And we lost something there, but it also adds an even more importance, an element of even more importance to the stuff that we did get from him with four decades of work and five Oscar nominations with two wins and just incredible legacy of characters and performances in movies with quotable lines all up and down the decades of amazing films.
I really just hope that those, you know, we know that he suffered from Alzheimer's at a certain point. I don't know when that was starting. I hope those next years were great. I hope he got great relaxation and great family time and things were good when he wasn't, you know, doing acting. You know, I don't know, but that's really what I hope.
Yeah, he got into, as I said, he got into painting. During this time, he started writing books. He, together with undersea archaeologist Daniel Lenihan, he wrote three historical fiction novels, Wake of the Perdido Star, which is a sea adventure from the 19th century, Justice for None, a Depression-era tale of murder, Escape from Andersonville, about a prison escape during the American Civil War, which I don't think was the Andersonville TV film they did. His first solo effort was a story of love and revenge set in the Old West titled Payback at Morning Peak, which was released in 2011. And his final novel was Pursuit, a police thriller in 2013. During his time as an actor, he got into racing, kind of like Paul Newman. He would race cars. He was part of the 24-hour race that happened there. I think Daytona, Santa Barbara, one of those things. So he would do all of that stuff. So he was always a guy who had a lot of things going on. And then as he got older, he understood his body, understood he had to relax, and that's what he did. And he was apparently very happily married. A lot of people say he met her, she was part-time working at a gym, and he didn't have his badge to get in. They struck up a conversation, and that's what started the romance. And they were married from 1991 on to their both unfortunate passing over a week ago, you know. And we're getting new details about what happened, and they're just heartbreaking and horrific. The new details are that he died a week after his wife died, that his wife had been dead for a week from a particular disease she contracted from rat excrement or mouse excrement that is from deer mouse there in that area in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So you're like, how did she get that? They were in a cul-de-sac. They weren't living out in the mountains somewhere away from people. And so it's just heartbreaking to hear of the way that he died, because he left such an incredible legacy of really wonderful performances. And I don't know how many actors he influenced to become an actor because of the work he did in all those movies. So, you know, just heartbreaking end to a wonderful actor and a wonderful life, and a very blessed life, honestly, considering his upbringing, considering the things he had to overcome in order to achieve it.
It's a really sad and lonely story.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's just something, you know, and knowing, you know, he had Alzheimer's, and you know, that means not necessarily able to take care of himself. And when your caregiver suddenly is sick, like what, he doesn't know what to, you know, it's one of those stories. And I'm sure you have things that I put my brain in that circumstance with them. And it just is so painful to think about what went on. And you know, I don't know what to say about it other than it's really sad.
Yeah.
And that's, again, I'm going to go back to, I hope up to that point, things were pretty good. I hope that he had times that were meaningful and good before those things happen. Cause you know, I love the guy, you know, he's just one of the greats, and I could watch him anytime. And I, it makes me very sad how it all ended.
Yeah. Agreed. And very gifted. Along with everything I mentioned already, he also designed 10 homes, Steve, which two of them were featured in Architectural Digest. So a man with many, many talents, clearly. But the number one thing is the acting, and that's what we'll remember. And that's what I hope a lot of people take away from this. And like you said, it's a horrible ending, and that's why I'm going in my 70s. I'm not sticking around past that time. And this is, you know, because I don't want to see that happen. And I think that's the truth of life, is you make your own decisions. And I think at that, to end in that way is sad. And I think it's a man who didn't deserve to end that way, considering the years, the decades of entertainment he's provided us all as a whole. So it is even more painful to know that that's how he ended. But what we focus on is the acting. What we focus on is the performances. What we focus on are the joy and just utter entertainment that we received from him. And one of the greats to ever do it, left on his own terms, which not a lot of people can do, and left a legacy here that many people will follow and be inspired by, with movies that I think will be passed on generation to generation because they're the greats, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, that's our tribute. Let's get into some questions from our fans, Steve. Anything more we want to say before we wrap up?
No, I'm excited about the questions.
Okay, let's do it. All right, first super chat here from Carlton Rudder, London calling. Unfortunately, my dad passed away today. Oh, no. Oh, Carlton. Oh, he was a great man, and Gene Hackman was one of his favorite actors. Love to you both. Steve, last week
Carlton, you had said that he wasn't doing well, and I'm just so sorry for your loss. And you mentioned the horrible club that, you know, John and I are members of, and you know, it's not a club anyone wants to be in, but it is. I'm so sorry, and you know, our best to all your family and to everyone who's grieving, and you know, get together, tell all the stories, laugh about stuff. That's the best thing to do.
Yeah, we send you love, man, and you'll go through the process. It'll take some time, but the goal is to hit that point where you appreciate the time you did have with him instead of mourning the time you lost. And that's a difficult process to get to, but once you get to that place, you're going to really be able to appreciate his presence in your life so much more than you would ever have imagined before, speaking from, you know, experience, having gone through this. But Carl, we send you our love and our thoughts of comforts and our condolences to you and your family, brother. And thank you for stopping, and you didn't have to, so thank you. Cowboys Fan 92 says, what's up, guys? How are you all? Hi, John. Hi, Steve. Love you, too. I've listened to your podcast, and I've listened for years now since I was in my 20s and now my early 30s.
It's weird. I mean, it's great, and thank you so much. But we were just saying how, like, you know, going like, oh, man, we're old. So if people have grown up with us. Apparently we've been on the show a long time.
I always think of that Billy Crystal bit with his daughter where she says to him, Dad, was Paul McCartney in a band before Wings?
Yeah.
Sketchcraft says, Lex Luthor was my first Gene Hackman experience. Unforgiven was my favorite role of his, and Crimson Tide in theaters was electrifying. Gene Gravitas Hackman.
Absolutely. Agreed.
Do you have a favorite role? Do you have a favorite Gene Hackman performance? I mean, that's tough.
I'm real big on Crimson Tide right now, so it's going to be tough for me to beat that one at this point. How about you?
Well, it's got to be Hoosiers.
Yeah,
of course. It's not even a question. I mean, French Connection, The Conversation, those are up there in terms of great performances. My favorite is Coach Norman Dale. Absolutely. Cowboys Fan also says, lastly, I'm a rare breed of film fan. After I've listened to an episode of The Pod, I go away and watch the film myself, Blues Brothers, Goodfellas, and more. Oh, that's great.
I mean, we've heard this a bunch. There are people that watch the movie religiously before listening to our show, and there are people who do not And sometimes people who've never even seen the movie, who listen to our show and then watch the movie. And there's even the rare cinephile who watches it, listens to the show, and then watches it again. And we admire those people's dedication.
Absolutely. Sometimes that's us. Sometimes that's us.
Yeah.
Sketchcraft also says, Superman, is that how a warped brain like yours gets its kicks? By planning the death of innocent people? Lex Luthor. No, by causing the death of innocent people, still the best Luthor on screen. Yeah.
Well, that's it. Because that's actually the real thing. Ooh. is that you could say not my Luthor, but has there been a better Lex Luthor on screen?
I don't think so.
I mean, it's Kevin Spacey, which is weird. Jesse Eisenberg, which is weird.
No.
Yeah, I don't think that. You're going to have to find someone better. Maybe we'll have a better one this year.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Not on film screens so far, but maybe TV screens for animated. Paul says, if you had the chance to direct Gene Hackman, would you have done it? How would you have approached that? Well, Steve is the feature film director, so I'll let Steve answer first. I'm the play, so I would probably focus more on the play directing. So go ahead, Steve.
Well, I mean, the answer is, of course I would have done it. I mean, we're assuming that Gene is right for the part, and we've discussed how big his range is, so he's right for most parts.
Yeah.
And how would I approach it? I mean, I start the same with every actor. I mean, like the first thing I would do, if it's possible, depending on schedule and the willingness of the actor, is you go out to lunch or coffee and you sit and you talk and you talk about the movie and you talk about the character. And ideally, I would let them talk. You know, that's the first that's why when you're directing, once you're on the set, time is money. You got to move. You got to get stuff in the can. And that's why having a little bit of time, that's why that going out to coffee or having a sandwich is so good, because now we can just talk. And I can listen to how the actor is talk, how they feel about the character, what they're seeing in the movie. I know I said it before, but like one of the greatest moments I've ever had was when I went to do exactly this with Stacey Keach, and he showed up with my script, dog-eared, with post-it notes everywhere, notes in the margin. And he went through and said, well, I was thinking about this and I was thinking about that. And this reminded me, and I thought the character might have this, but I just sat and listened.
Yeah.
Because the thing about that is you ask the question of how do you approach the actor? Well, I need to learn about them and what their thinking is, and that's going to teach me how to approach it. So some actors want a lot of discussion and a lot of back and forth. Some actors, they have it, and they're like, don't talk to me. I know what I'm going to do. And if Gene Hackman was like, don't talk to me, I know what I'm going to do, I would not talk to him and let him do his thing. Now, if he did his thing and I didn't like it, which seems unbelievably unlikely, but if for some reason, then I would direct him in a way that seemed appropriate to that actor. Every actor needs to be directed differently. And I can't know how to direct them until I've actually spoken to them, you know?
Well, and Hackman said in the actor studio, what's the one thing you hate? And he said, directions from directors, you know? And so I think Steve, but he likes them when the directors like do a simplistic direction, like what they need and they're clear about it. And so having worked with Steve, I know that's something he would absolutely be able to do with Gene Hackman. So it could lead to a fantastic performance. I won't go in too deep. I would just say I would love to direct him in Death of a Salesman. I mean, the fact that him as Willy Loman would be such a fantastic role for him to play. If you find the right young actors to play his sons.
But how about Timothy Chalamet can be one of them?
Oh, that could be. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. And he is like, he could have played the role because, I mean, like he was a salesman in early days of his life when he was trying to make money to support his acting. So you've got that experience. He's from a Midwestern town. So it has that element. He probably knew guys who are like this. And so I think there's a lot he could have brought to it. And he had kids. So there's a lot that I think he could have brought to it that would have been phenomenal to see, whether on screen or on stage. And so that's the role that I think I would have cast him in if I could have, you know, and I would love to have directed him in that and kept out of his way.
Yeah.
All right. We have one stream that came through, Steve, as we wrap up here. This is from Justin Toner. Thank you, Justin. He says, hi, guys. Been looking forward to the show. It's been a rough week for me. Been sick. Oh, sorry, buddy. Gene Hackman became one of my favorite actors growing up. So many great performances in movies. What a legacy he left behind us and others to enjoy. One of the best.
Agreed. I have nothing to add.
Agreed, Justin. I'll add that we hope you feel better, brother. And, you know, we both I'm trying to avoid being sick. I know, Steve, I think you were battling it recently. And so it's just like, you got to try to stay even keel there. So do your best there, Justin. Rest up as much as possible. All right, Steve, we should wrap up our conversations. We hit the hour and a half mark. It's usually how long we go with these episodes. Any final words, or did you already deliver them? What are your thoughts here?
No, I just, you know, I think I've already delivered them. I'll go back to where we started, which is I think he is one of the greats to ever grace the silver screen. And we're never going to see anybody. There's never going to be another Gene Hackman. There'll be great actors again, but Gene Hackman's Gene Hackman.
I think there's a conversation to be had about putting Hackman on the Mount Rushmore. I think you'd honestly have a conversation about it, considering his ability to play multiple type of characters in multiple type of genre films and be extremely successful doing so. So, yeah, look, I love him. I'm still kind of broken up about it. Every time I watch him on screen, I catch myself smiling because I'm just enjoying the talent and enjoying the purity of an actor delivering honest performances in these movies. And I think that's his greatest gift, is that he made us care about him no matter what role he was playing, and whether villain or hero. And that's not easy to do. And it was because of who he was as a person.
Yeah.
And so we've lost a light, not only as an actor, but as a human being. And that's tough, you know. So.
Agreed.
All right. Well, there you go. That's our conversation and our tribute and our remembrance for Gene Hackman. Thank you all so much for joining us live. And for those of you who are listening to us later on the podcast, we appreciate it as well. Steve, what do we have to tell them as we are wrapping up our show?
Well, if you haven't already, please like this video and subscribe to our YouTube feed, and also subscribe to all the other podcast subscribey places that you like. Reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify are always great. You can buy or stream every film we've ever reviewed, and I'll even put up a special Gene Hackman page with a link to this video, and we'll put up a bunch of his top movies, so you can buy or stream any of those on cinephiles.net.
Oh yeah,
we already discussed all the benefits on patreon.com/thecinephiles. Some of those benefits are duplicated through Apple Podcasts. If you're an Apple person, you could subscribe there. And as you can see below me, I'm SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
And as for me, at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Blue Sky, because I'm on Blue Sky as well. And my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays. Going live more, doing more stuff. We just had some pretty cool episodes of the Geek Buddies and the Hot Mic that you all can enjoy. But I'll be going live more and more every week. So come on and subscribe to the channel and hang out with me live as we talk about what's going on in the world of entertainment and the world in general in those conversations. Thank you so much for joining us. You guys have been amazing. To all of our Cinephiles fans, we love you. Don't forget to subscribe to our Patreon, as Steve said, and don't forget to support all the people who support us here on the channel in terms of the sponsors and the clients who help us bring the show to you every week. All right, take care of yourselves. Be well. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode of The Cinephiles. Peace, everybody. Right.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.